Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
A state commission to oversee the 2020 census count for New York State adopted its action plan this week, but immigrant rights groups worry that it's too little, too late. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The commission gave unanimous approval to a plan that includes directing resources to hard-to-count communities, estimated to contain at least 4.8 million people. Many are in the African American and Latinx communities. But there's also concern that since the census will be for the first time conducted mostly online, predominantly white rural New Yorkers with poor internet access may also be missed. Jim Malotras, commission chair and former director of state operations under Governor Andrew Cuomo, says there's a lot at stake, including federal funds for health care programs, food stamps, and school lunches for the needy.
If you have 100 students but you only count 75 in a census, you're still paying for 100 students. You're just not getting funding for 100 students any longer.
The census is also used to allot political representation. New York's overall population is growing at a slower rate than other states. It already stands to lose 2 congressional seats. Malotra says other concerns include an underfunded federal census bureau, and there was also publicity over President Donald Trump's administration's unsuccessful attempt to include a citizenship question on the census.
There's a chilling effect to that. Some people think it's still there, and that may lead to them not actually filling out the census. So part of our mission is to work with local communities, local organizations, state entities, any partner who will work with us, organized labor, to make sure those folks are actually filling out the census form.
The plan was issued several months after its deadline. Under law, the commission was to have completed its report on funding needed for the census count by January of 2019. But the commissioners weren't even appointed until January, and the first of the 2 reports due in July was released Tuesday. Malotra says, though there's a lot to do, he's confident the state will be ready when the count begins early next year. He says some of the report's recommendations, like having a robust marketing campaign for the census, can't be carried out until next year anyway.
I think there's plenty of time to do things.
But immigrants' rights groups say the delay has been harmful. Meeta Anand is with the New York Immigration Coalition.
To say that they're on target by issuing it on October 8th is incorrect.
Anand says immigrants' rights groups wanted $40 million to pay for programs and staff to help convince people in undercounted communities that it's in their interest to complete the census. But she says they only got $20 million. Some commissioners also expressed concerns about the delays and the funding amounts. Jose Calderon, president of the Hispanic Federation, was appointed by Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie.
Around the importance of releasing this money as quickly as possible, because the reality is that we are delayed in that process.
Amy Torres with the Chinese American Planning Council says it's caused her group to question Cuomo's commitment to an effective and accurate count.
To see that the commission is still hemming and hawing over what the right amount of money is, how it should go out, how it could possibly be spent, further shows that the governor is not truly interested in supporting a full and complete count of New York State.
Senior advisor to Cuomo, Rich Azzapardi, says there's not been any foot dragging.
That's 100% incorrect. The governor's commitment to making sure that every New Yorker is counted, to make sure that every man, woman, and child in New York is properly counted, to make sure that the census process is not a backdoor invitation to ICE and any other flawed federal policy coming out of Washington that's based in hate and fear-mongering. We've been all over that for the last several years on it.
The count begins next April and will continue through the summer. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Federal lawmakers, including the Senate Minority Leader, announced a new package of bills aimed at improving limo safety late last week in Amsterdam. At the same time, New York State lawmakers are calling for more action just before the anniversary of last year's deadly crash in Schoharie that killed 20. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard reports.
On October 6, 2018, a modified stretch limousine carrying 17 passengers crashed after coming down a steep hill in Schoharie, killing all on board and two bystanders. Thursday, federal lawmakers appeared with family members of the victims in Amsterdam to outline legislation that will be introduced in the U.S. House and Senate to improve limo safety. And state lawmakers are calling for similar laws at the state level. Assemblyman Angelo Santabarbara, a member of the Transportation Committee, was in attendance Thursday. The Democrat authored a number of limo safety bills introduced in the last year. He wants lawmakers to return to Albany for a special session before the legislature reconvenes in January.
If there was ever reason to go back, this is a top issue. This is a very important issue. If there's ever reason to go back, I can't imagine any legislator that's going to say, no, I don't want to go back for this issue. You know, These are bills that can be passed, and I think they would pass unanimously.
Senator James Tedisco, a Republican, agrees.
I believe we have to come back, and I'm asking the leaders in both the Senate and the Assembly and the governor to call a special session and bring us back in to deal with this issue and pass the bills in both houses and come to an agreement and stop just pontificating and talking about what we need to do and get it done.
At least 29 pieces of legislation pertaining to limousine safety have been introduced, covering everything from closing loopholes to requiring seatbelt use. On Wednesday, the National Transportation Safety Board released a report detailing deficiencies in the 2001 Ford Excursion stretch limo owned by Prestige Limousine in last year's crash. NTSB Chair Robert Sumwalt discussed the recommendations made to state and federal agencies with WAMC.
The takeaways for this would be that we need three things. We need good seat integrity, which includes the anchorages. We need well-designed restraint systems, such as lap shoulder belts. And we know that seat belts do you no good at all if you're not wearing them. So we need proper seat belt usage.
Last year, the state Senate and Assembly could not come to agreement on limo regulations, though each house did pass its own package of bills. Here's Senator Tim Kennedy, who chairs the Senate Transportation Committee, speaking at a June press conference just prior to the end of session.
From requiring seatbelts in every vehicle carrying nine or more passengers to mandating commercial driver's licenses and drug and alcohol testing for drivers for for-hire vehicles, we're taking significant steps to ensure safety measures are firmly in place when anyone steps into one of these vehicles.
Some new limousine regulations were included as part of Governor Andrew Cuomo's state budget. Among the provisions, new criminal penalties were created for operating unsafe vehicles. Limos are now prohibited from making U-turns, a factor in a 2015 deadly crash on Long Island. The State Department of Transportation was given authority to seize license plates from vehicles deemed unsafe, and more oversight was given to the Department of Motor Vehicles to ensure vehicles comply with federal safety standards. Assemblywoman Amy Pollan, a Democrat who is the co-sponsor of several limo safety bills, including seatbelt requirements, said this week in a statement, quote, "We need to make sure we are doing everything we can to prevent the operation of these vehicles in an unsafe manner that could put our children and our loved ones in danger," end quote. For more coverage of the limo crash and its aftermath, visit WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Well, we've seen quite the fight, Alan, in New York over President Trump's state tax returns. We had a judge say that the president had to turn them over, and he appealed it, and that was a stay. What do you make of New York possibly getting a hold of his tax returns?
Well, let me put it this way. I don't think this president has any intention of giving anybody his tax returns, no matter what. He does, to some degree, the president, own the courts at this stage of the game. So, you know, Cy Vance comes along and says, give me those tax returns. It's a good move for Cy Vance, by the way, David, because you know, he has made his own series of mistakes, and this puts him in a good spot with New York voters. On the other hand, do I think that this president has any intention of complying? No, I do not.
Story by our Karen DeWitt in the program today, Alan, about immigrant rights groups worried about the action plan that was adopted this week by the State Commission that oversees the 2020 census. They're worried that it's a little too late.
Well, it could be too late. The fact is, we know what this president is doing. It's all about protecting the people of privilege from the other. The other are the black and brown people, some of whom come over the borders, some of whom need protection here in this country. And David, the fact is that it's all consistent. They do not want more people of color in the voting rolls in the United States. I know that. We all know it. All that should happen here is that everybody gets an equal break. But it's clear where this president is coming from and what he's doing and how it affects populations like New York's.
Interesting column by Chris Churchill from the Times Union, someone who has appeared on WAMC and on our roundtable program. He writes about the 19th District Representative, Antonio Delgado, playing with fire, and that's a purple district, when it comes to backing impeachment.
Well, he didn't have any choice, obviously. If you don't vote for impeachment right now and you're a Democrat, and the Democrats have this incredible anger about the president, you could be primaried, and you could be primaried quite easily. So those people who are sitting on the fence have stopped sitting on the fence. They've come over. The pro-impeachment inquiry vote is one that they have taken. He didn't really have a great deal of choice in what he was doing there.
Senator Schumer making the rounds in New York State this week. He stopped in Kent, New York, at an abandoned mine, Alan, where it was discovered that this mine was leaking arsenic into the public drinking water for 30 years. And we've certainly seen one after the other, whether it's PFOA or PFOS, mm-hmm. or the other problems with lead in water and other things that are in many of our communities in New York and across the country.
But, David, this is arsenic. Arsenic is a terrible poison. The senator was quite right. He said the EPA has the money to do the cleanup. They should do the cleanup. But if it gets political and if it's New York and this president says nothing for New York, that would be terrible. And it does go down into the agencies. So this is a very, very bad problem. Schumer was quite correct to raise it. And it is something that absolutely needs to be attended to.
And you're seeing that fight continuing on the Hudson River. You've got the New York DEC fighting against the EPA to say, hey, the job isn't done.
Yeah, well, we know it's not done. We know there's still stuff in there. There was an early agreement. Everybody agreed to it. But right now, we know the job is not done. There's still stuff in the river. It needs to be taken out. And we need to protect people so that they can swim there, they can fish there, they can enjoy the beauty of the great Hudson River. The fact that it's not being done, it just shows you how crass we can be in our politics.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The Dutchess and Ulster County executives say they will take legal action in support of New York State's lawsuit against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency over General Electric's Hudson River PCB cleanup decision. Some cities, towns, and villages in the two counties are lending their support as well. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
Democratic legislator Nick Page says the resolution he and others have submitted would direct the county to do its part to address the climate crisis.
The bill set forward getting all county electricity purchasing done through either local renewable sources or renewable energy certificates for 2020. So that would be the first action item. And then again, it would be on the county administration to put forward a plan forward to hit the targets, the reduction targets, and they would need to report back to the legislature in February of 2020.
He says the resolution was inspired by Democratic Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan's executive order in June.
These targets are exactly what Pat Ryan put forth in his executive order in June, and we'd like to match that.
The resolution also mentions Schenectady and Sullivan counties as making progress toward climate goals. Andy Bicking is Poughkeepsie-based Scenic Hudson's Director of Public Policy.
We were certainly excited to see Ulster County move in this direction, and we think it's really important for local government to align themselves with state policies to help deal with the issue of climate change that we're having, both the emissions that we're putting out as a community, but also the energy that we're using. So we're certainly encouraged anytime we see other counties take notice of Ulster's work and begin moving in that direction.
Liz Moran is Environmental Policy Director for the New York Public Interest Research Group.
We are in the midst of a climate crisis. So it's important for municipalities to step up to the plate and do what they can to make sure they're aligning with the state's climate goals. That being said, the resolution that they are putting forward should align with the state's new climate goals. We have important statewide goals to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, and municipalities should be making sure that they're prepared to do the same. It's fantastic that Dutchess County is looking at ways that they can do that as well.
The Dutchess resolution sets a preliminary goal of a 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions associated with county operations by 2030, and an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions associated with county operations by 2050. New York State adopted the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act this year, and Moran would like to see counties moving up at least one of the markers.
The goals that they have proposed, though theirs and Ulster's, are actually slightly different from the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Their goals are 80% by 2050 on a local level. We would encourage them to consider the same goal that the state has, at least 85%, with a goal of net zero by 2050.
Page addresses the resolution's timing.
So we've submitted it for the October agenda, so the agenda hasn't been released yet, but our hope is that it will be on the Environmental Committee agenda for our October 10 meeting, and then would go to the floor in front of the full body for our October board meeting.
Just last week, Republican Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro announced the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation certified the county has earned bronze-level designation in the Climate Smart Community Program.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Fresh off the national campaign trail, New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand renewed her push for legislation that would create a real national paid family and medical leave policy for all American workers. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas has more.
The New York Democrats' Family Act has been around since 2013. She feels it has been gaining ground, inspired by a new report that considers her proposal to be the top paid family leave model among voters of all parties.
Last week, Data for Progress released a report showing what we already knew. Americans overwhelmingly support a real national paid leave, family and medical leave policy that's accessible, affordable, and which they own. Americans know that at some point in their lives, everyone will need to take care and take time off to care for themselves or a loved one. And 61% of them said they would expect to face significant hardship if they had to take unpaid time off.
Gillibrand, who gave up her presidential campaign in late August, maintains the costs of hiring and training someone new are greater than providing leave to current employees.
It isn't surprising, since the U.S. is the only industrialized country that doesn't guarantee its workers some form of paid leave. That's shameful. But the study emphasized something even more remarkable. It showed that two-thirds of voters support the Family Act that I've championed in the Senate for years. We know the bill that would work because it's modeled after successful programs all across the country. The Family Act would ensure that every worker, part-time or full-time, large employer or small business, young or old, can take up to 12 weeks of paid leave off for personal or family medical leave emergency or the addition of a child to the family. It creates a fully separate earned benefit, a self-sustaining family insurance program funded through small contributions by employers and employees, and it costs about the cost of a cup of coffee a week.
Gillibrand has been pressing the issue for years. In April 2015, in Troy, Gillibrand cited a different poll conducted by the Small Business Majority, which found 6 in 10 entrepreneurs in New York State supported a publicly administered family and medical leave program. She spoke at First Playable Productions in Troy, a video game company of 46 employees, whose CEO, Toby Sonier, told WAMC her employees worked together to establish a paid leave policy and that Gillibrand's Family Act would help the company extend its policy and encourage other small businesses to adopt their own.
For small businesses in particular, it can be quite challenging to make a paid leave work. Not only do we have staffing logistics required to still meet our business commitments, the financial impact can be quite daunting.
Gillibrand says she's calling on Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to bring the Family Act to the floor for a vote.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gistina. U.S. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has announced a program to train New York college students to work in the cybersecurity industry. The Legislative Gazette's Jim Lavoulis reports.
Speaking at the University at Albany Monday, the Democrat says the school's College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity would be the hub of a pilot program to train students to fill nearly 314,000 cybersecurity job openings nationwide, including 15,000 in New York.
U of Albany would be the hub. They would do sort of the high end. What's the next phase? How are these bad guys going to hack us, and what can we do to protect ourselves ahead of time? And that kind of advanced thinking. But at the same time, the spokes that would come out of this would be at the community colleges training people to go to companies and other institutions to how to protect themselves against cyber theft. What kind of protection modes are there? Do they exist? And how to deal with the cyber hacking when and if it occurs.
Launched in 2015, UAlbany's College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity has about 2,000 students. Schumer says the median salary for an information security analyst with a bachelor's degree is $115,000 a year. The Democrat says under his proposal, $3.7 million in federal funding would go to the SUNY system. The minority leader says he already has bipartisan support and intends to tie the legislation to an upcoming appropriations bill. Schumer pointed to hacks of school and government systems in New York as examples of the dangers of the activity. In March, the city of Albany was the victim of a ransomware attack.
You may remember that the attack caused issues for Albany's police force. Officers were unable to see what their patrolling needs were. When they were out in the patrol cars, they couldn't speak either to headquarters or to other police cars that were around the area. They couldn't speak, that is, electronically. It crippled other municipal systems for days because the locals were unable to receive, say, birth certificates, death certificates, marriage licenses. The Syracuse City School District was hacked and had to pay tens of thousands of dollars of ransom to regain access to the system.
The city of Albany paid about $300,000 to upgrade its systems following the attack. Robert Griffin, the dean of UAlbany's College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity, says estimates show the global cost of hacking and cyber attacks will approach $6 trillion annually by 2021. By that summer, UAlbany plans to open its new Emerging Technology and Entrepreneurship Complex to house the school's security programs and serve as the headquarters for Schumer's pilot program. UAlbany's provost, Carol Kim, says the 246,000-square-foot complex cost $180 million.
ETech is the epicenter of UAlbany's academic, research, and business collaborations on climate, security, emergency preparedness, emerging technologies, and the environment.
In Albany, I'm Jim Lavoulis.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask program number 1941. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustino.